Chief Justice Steele, members of the court, it is my understanding that the tribunal wishes that we focus on the issue of harmless error, that aspect of this appeal, as opposed to the initial argument that admission of the evidence was erroneous. The plaintiffs here contend that we suffered significant prejudice when the trial court admitted physically into evidence the printed material published by the American College of Cardiology labeled guidelines. They did that in support of their argument that the dosage of amiodarone, which was given to this patient, was acceptable in the sense that there were no parameters. You could give whatever you wanted for however long you chose to, and these guidelines did not specify any boundaries. Our evidence at trial came from two experts, cardiologists, that the dosage was inappropriate at all in one case, and secondly, that it was inappropriate for the amount of time that it was given. In the defense part of the case, they presented a witness who was a member of this committee that formulated these guidelines. He was described as the man who wrote the book. And then they introduced the book into evidence over strenuous objection from the plaintiffs. The question now...
I thought they introduced pages from the book.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes.
Not the entire book.
That's correct. It was excerpts. It was four pages. The issue then became whether or not these guidelines would be a significant factor in the jury's deliberation, or whether it was just merely cumulative and didn't mean anything anyway because they'd already heard the testimony from the witness. We can't know for certain, of course, what prompted the jury to decide the way it did. But we can know that the defense attached high importance to this evidence, fought vigorously to get it introduced, then used it as the roadmap for the closing argument, and started right off with that, told the jury where to find it in the exhibit booklet, told them how to work through the guidelines going page by page, and they obviously thought it was of some considerable significance and was the focal point of the defense closing argument.
Do you agree that the defense expert, that if he had taken the big chart or a smart board or whatever and personally drawn this same algorithm, that could have been either with the smart board printed out or with an old-fashioned chart, torn off and marked as an exhibit and been introduced because it was his testimony in court?
I think that's a thorny question, and it came up at the time of the prior argument in the context of a witness memorizing what is in a text, describing it as text material, and then writing it out and introducing it. I think that's a clever way to circumvent the rule.
Well, how about, apart from any witness, the witness who says that the diagram in the book is his diagram and it's his own personal thought, and therefore if he had drawn it out, would it have been admissible?
Probably. I think it would be a discretionary matter with the trial judge, and if the trial judge saw it as a means of getting around the rule, then I would ask the judge to exclude it. If not, then I think it would come in. And I know it's been customary in many medical malpractice trials for portions of testimony to be written on a board and introduced into evidence. As I say, the defense here obviously attached importance to the physical document. And I submit that the trial judge did also. In her decision denying our motion for a new trial, she explained the reasons that this material was admitted, and then she said, and this is at page 5 of her opinion, the matters at issue in the case are not simple. Reducing the analysis to a flowchart which jurors could follow and refer to in deliberations and accompanying the chart with the pages which explain the abbreviations in the chart and contain the data related to dosage provided a vehicle to assist the jury in understanding the witness's testimony. And that, I submit, is specifically what the rule of evidence is designed to prevent or avoid, not to let a piece of printed material, which is admittedly authoritative, become the make weight in the case. That was the rationale behind the rule. Our position is that it was not adhered to in this case, and it may very well have been the signal event in the jury's deliberations. We can't, of course, know that, but the evidence we do have certainly points in that direction.
Mr. Castle, I have a problem with the, I guess, the basic premise of your position. That is the argument that the algorithm, which is so described, constituted a treatise for purposes of the evidentiary rule. And I say that because your side introduced a protocol, which has been described as an algorithm. The other side introduced a protocol that's been described as an algorithm. Your argument is that your algorithm is not a treatise, but the other side's is. But there's nothing in the briefs that really clarifies in any doctrinal way why that should be so. That is, if the other side's protocol is a treatise, why yours isn't, or if yours isn't, why theirs is?
Our position is that theirs is a broad general outline that's designed for the entire population of patients suffering from atrial fibrillation. The protocol that the cardiac surgery unit at the hospital adopted was very specific for the precise condition that Mr. Berry had, and that is for somebody who undergoes this type of an operation and then experiences this condition, then this is what you look to solve the problem. It's very specific to that, nothing else. Theirs is, in our view of things, a learned treatise in the sense that it is general and is designed for the entire population.
Is it correct that the expert witness through whom it was presented explained its purpose, which would include the generality of its application as you just described it, and that you had an opportunity to cross-examine him about that?
Yes.
As I read Weinstein and Jones on evidence and some other, I'll use the word treatises, that attempt to explain the rule, they seem to suggest that the reason that treatises, learned treatises, are barred from the jury is the danger that the jury will pick them up, read through them, and start using portions of them which have not been explained by an expert or about which an expert has not been cross-examined, and as a result go off on a frolic of their own in resolving the facts that are presented to them. But that in this case, the general guideline that you object to in short form, algorithm form, or otherwise, was indeed explained through the witness, through the questions on direct and questions on cross-examination, and it seems to me that narrows the danger and perhaps undercuts your view of the purpose of the rule somewhat. So
I think it narrows
with that in mind, in a harmless error context, what danger was the jury presented, as it's explained by Weinstein and others who discussed the rule, as a result of this going to the jury?
Let me try to address it this way, Your Honor. I agree with your first suggestion that the entire volume coming in and the jury goes off on a frolic of its own. That is one of the objectives of the rule. However, the rule is not limited to that, and it does not provide an exception if a witness is going to focus in on one paragraph in a 1,000-page volume as being significant and explain that to the jury, and then the trial judge can introduce that into evidence or allow that to be introduced into evidence. The rule doesn't say that. The rule bars the general danger that you're talking about as well as the specific danger. And it certainly emphasizes that particular piece of evidence and gives it a weight that the rulemakers didn't think it should have.
Well, let's assume that's true. The question then becomes, is that error in this case, hypothetically, reversible error?
If the court looks to the Hughes test that deals with whether the case is close or not and whether this was central to an issue in the case, I think the answer has to be yes. Clearly it was a close case.
But that is an extension of Hughes you're arguing for, is that?
It is. I noticed in our briefs I pointed out that Hughes was used in a civil case some years ago. I'm aware that this court recently ruled in the Barrow case and seemed to apply that rule without saying so in so many words, and that's just within the past month.
Well, another way to look at it, making analogy to the criminal law, is the harmless error context where the court, appellate court, is called upon to look at the entire record and say that the appellate court is convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that notwithstanding this error, the jury would have reached the same result.
In a criminal context.
Correct. And so how would we apply that analogy? The argument from your opponent would be we should reach that conclusion because the expert testified about the chart and there was so much testimony and discussion about the chart during the expert's presentation that letting the jury take the chart with them was harmless because they'd already been immersed into that piece of evidence.
We don't know. I think that argument can certainly be made. All I know is that the judge and counsel had a hard time understanding what this chart was all about when it was being introduced into evidence, and the defense went right up to the jury in closing argument and said, get this out and let's look at it. We're going to go through this item by item, page by page, which is designed to make the jury's task as easy as possible. And that may very well be what happened. And the test, I would go back to the Coe decision in which the court said, we can't say that the defense counsel's improper closing argument did not have a substantial impact.
Well, and Coe is a civil case, and that's why I brought up this analogy to harmless error. Coe looks like the harmless error test in civil cases.
I'm happy with that here.
Mr. Castle, to shift gears for a moment and go back to what is a treatise issue, let's assume hypothetically that the defendant's protocol or algorithm, you know, however we may want to term it, happened to have one page that described precisely the physical malady that the decedent in this case had and the protocol for treating it. It was right on point in those circumstances. And if that is, if the defendants wanted to use that one page in the manner that they used it here, would that be a treatise?
I think the premise of the hypothetical is not solidly based. I don't think any kind of general medical information could ever be that precise.
Well, that's a symbol.
Two aspirin for this particular condition. I don't think that exists.
It is conceivable, is it not, that a learned treatise could, in one of its 1,000 pages, have a description of the precise syndrome that the deceased plaintiff had discourses about what the course of treatment should be.
I would invoke the rule and say, Your Honor, the rule doesn't allow it.
Isn't that what you did here? I mean, your distinction. The distinction between your protocol and the other side's protocol is that I think it was in your own words that the syndrome was specific to this plaintiff. That was the only difference.
Well,
what you successfully got into evidence was a treatise as well. Is that your position?
No, I don't call that a treatise. And there was no objection based on
business record?
It is a business record. It wasn't introduced as that. But there was no objection, Your Honor, based on Evidence Rule 18.
Well, in civil cases, the courts like the Third Circuit that have come out with harmless error say the exhibit was duplicative of the testimony, and therefore it was harmless. In this case, was the exhibit really duplicative of the expert's testimony?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, there's certainly overlapped.
And as I read some of the other cases, like Frakes from Tennessee and the Mankin case, that they also seem to focus on whatever the document is, whether it's a chart, whether it's a table, whether it's a protocol, whether it's a page from a learned treatise. The real important factor is whether or not there was an expert who testified about its significance and the other side who opposed the admission had an opportunity to cross-examine and test that expert and the chart or the protocol about which the expert testified, which eventually got in the hands of the jury. So there's a certain comfort level that the jury, in all probability, would not be confused about that document and would not read into it a significance that wasn't fully explored before them at trial. Isn't that the situation here?
No, because nobody understood this document. Defense counsel didn't understand it. Plaintiff's counsel didn't understand it. The doctor who was testifying was one of 20-some authors of this. He even said, if my colleagues heard me testifying about this, they would, I forget the expression he used, but
skin me alive,
something like that. And when the document was offered into evidence, there was this lengthy colloquy with the court, and nobody could figure out exactly what this thing meant. The only important part of it was that it didn't set any borders on the dosage of this medicine. And the trial judge, in her post-trial opinion, even seems to describe it that way when she says this case is not simple.
Was there an objection, a 403 objection, that this would confuse everybody because nobody knew what it meant?
I didn't cite 403, but I said confuse. I did make that objection.
And what did the trial court say in response to that?
Well, we've set it out in the briefs. The full transcript is there.
I can find
She
that.
Never addressed the rule of evidence, and simply after listening to all the arguments and with the witness on the stand, participating in the discussion, by the way, she then said, I'm going to admit this, 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 and this. And that was that.
This was all done in front of the jury?
No. The jury was excused. Unless there are other questions, I have nothing further, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely.
Can I interrupt before
yes.
you even begin?
Sure.
Would you agree generally, I know this is kind of a hard one to agree to, but would you agree generally with opposing counsel's description of your closing argument as having used this particular document as a roadmap with the jury?
I would characterize, I don't necessarily agree with that, and here's why. All of the evidence regarding the ACC guidelines that came in during the trial was admissible. The only issue is whether these three pages, or four pages, it's combined in one, that went back to the jury somehow affected the substantial rights of the party. So every argument that I made in closing regarding the importance of the ACC guidelines, regarding my expert, Dr. Krastowski's testimony, regarding the use of the guidelines, how they were developed, how this drug came about and it didn't have a dosage regimen, all of those points that I emphasized were fair comments on the evidence that was induced at trial.
I understand that, and I understand you're attempting to draw a distinction between the actual document and what was clearly admissible evidence and proper discussion in closing, but I think it may be significant to know whether you agree that basically in closing argument you led the jury through to the conclusion you were looking for and explained how to reach that conclusion by using this document as the vehicle of, you know, of demonstrating why your position was correct.
That document was one part of the entire evidence in the trial. I mean, there's no question that during closing I referenced that document, but this was a case of dueling documents. The jury had the benefit of the plaintiff's cardiac surgery service manual, which I would suggest is a more complex array as you go through that than the simple documents that were fully explained by my expert. So, yes, I did use that during the closing. But had that document not been there, I could have still led the jury through the entirety of the expert analysis, the expert opinions of my expert, Dr. Prostowski, and the sort of history of evidence-based medicine. And I think that's important because the standard of care in a lot of ways for cardiologists and other specialists develops through evidence-based medicine. So I could have still made those same arguments and those same points and emphasized them in the same way during my closing argument. So the to aid the jury to have the document doesn't prejudice the plaintiff where there's competing documents. And I could have argued all of the points regarding the ACC guidelines and the use and the dosage and duration of that drug independent of whether that exhibit was with the jury or not. So you know, and as I understand the purpose of the rule of reading a treatise into evidence and not having it admitted, is this fear that all of a sudden the jury is going to have a textbook or a portion of a textbook, and then they're going to go through it and they're going to start coming up with their own sort of thinking and opinions that aren't supported by expert testimony. It's important to remember in this case that these three documents, which were authored, you know, it by the person on the stand, he was subject to cross-examination. It's not like we got a book or a treatise that Dr. Jones now adopts and makes it part of his opinion, and he's up there and we're rifling through it. I mean, he wrote these things and was involved in it and thoroughly explained each and every part of it. And this was merely demonstrative of his opinion. He could have taken, gone down in front of the jury. I could have had him draw a chart. I could have had him made these charts up independently on his own and said, here's an exhibit that I'm offering, Dr. Prostowski's chart. It just so happened that he did it in 2001 as part of the ACC guidelines, and that document was used to help the jury to understand what was a very complex case.
But that's still hearsay, though, if he makes it out of court in 2001 or the day before.
It is still hearsay, but some of the concerns or risks regarding hearsay are minimized where that expert is on the stand and subject to cross-examination. And the purpose of the part of the learned treatise section of the rule that says read and don't admit is that the jury doesn't rifle through. That fear or that concern is not met. I think it's important in this case to, you know, we're talking about three pages, and they're offered to rebut what the plaintiffs make is the theme of their case is this cardiac surgery service manual. So really, in fairness to the defense, the jury should have the evidence that's out there to judge a doctor whether he's meeting the standard of care.
Well, let's assume hypothetically that these four pages should not have gone to the jury. Tell us why the verdict should stand and that it basically was harmless.
Because all of the evidence that came in wouldn't have changed. All of the Dr. Prostowski's testimony about the duration and use of this drug, Dr. Dory's testimony about, you know, evidence-based medicine, and all of the testimony would have come in. In fact, this document was displayed before the jury without objection, before it was admitted. So they had already seen it. So, you know, they had looked at it. They had seen it. It was a reference point. So what difference or harm came because they had it back there, especially in a situation where there is sort of this cardiac, this other side that the plaintiffs are trying to emphasize and use. So there's no, listen, this was a very It was a complex case. It involved.
No, we understand
right.
that. But you're saying that these charts were duplicative of the testimony.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And on the issue of harmless error, if you look at the charts, one of plaintiff's own experts, Dr. Marsh, two of these documents, I can get the reference so the record is clear. I think it was A21, which is the recommendations for management of patients with atrial fibrillation. And then the other was A17, which was what was called the algorithm, heart disease go down, coronary artery disease, this amiodarone. Those two documents dealt with the situation of whether or not you use amiodarone for postoperative, post-CABG cardiac bypass surgery, atrial fibrillation. On that point, the plaintiff's own expert conceded it was an appropriate drug. So how can you claim a prejudice from a point that your own expert says it's okay, it's within the standard of care? So I would claim on those two documents, at a minimum, their expert says it's okay to use it. That's all they show. So clearly there could be no prejudice from that. The other document is a dosage scheme. It's A19, recommended dosage. And remember the history of this drug. There was no pharmacokinetics, so there wasn't a dosage regimen set out from studies and science when the FDA approved it. So this was sort of a consensus because many physicians were using different dosage regimens. On the dosages, the plaintiff's own expert, Dr. Marsh, agreed that, 1.2 grams, which is 400 milligrams three times a day, and then 200 to 400 milligrams a day, that those were acceptable dosages. Now, the dosage was, the loading dose was exceeded a little bit in here, and Mr. Castle pointed that out in his closing argument. But the point is that the plaintiff's expert conceded that those were appropriate dosages. So then the issue comes down to, well, what's the prejudice from admitting a document that has a dosage that essentially is in the same parameters of the dosage that the plaintiff's expert says, and in fact is duplicative of Dr. Prostowski's extensive testimony sort of regarding the history of dosages and how you use it. Now, plaintiffs claim that there's the absence of duration in there. Well, I would suggest that the absence of information in here in a dosage doesn't create an issue of significant prejudice that would affect the substantial rights of the parties in a case like this where there's a lot of expert testimony, there's a lot of documents.
You've explained to us that the chart that was admitted, to which Mr. Castle objects, was in fact shown to the jury in the jury room, explained by an expert witness on direct, and that expert witness was cross-examined by Mr. Castle on his opinion of the significance of that particular item that the jury still has in front of it as the doctor's testifying. Now, some of us have an experience that trial lawyers introduce documents into evidence that they know will go to the jury room as opposed to just have documents shown to the jury in the courtroom because they believe that having it in the jury room creates a significant impact on the jury during deliberations to the degree that might have a bearing on the outcome. Now, you seem to be suggesting by some of your comments, and if I'm interpreting them incorrectly, let me know, that it's no big deal that it went to the jury room because the jury had already seen it, already had it explained. It was of no added significance. If that's true, why did you move it in as an exhibit so it could get to the jury room?
I think because there were competing documents. So, during the trial, the plaintiffs present their side, the defense presents their side. And then when the jury goes back and they're considering the evidence, they get the plaintiff's side and the defense side. I mean, it was dueling flowcharts, for lack of a better word. And once that other cardiac surgery manual was in, then I think the jury, in order to have, fairness to the defense, would consider all of the evidence. Now, you know, did the jury, would they have forgotten everything that Dr. Prostowski said, and would they have forgotten all of the exhibits? I mean, it's important to remember there were other exhibits, too, regarding dosages and duration of amiodarone. My client, Dr. Dory, had a chart that had Bronwald's and NASPI, because the dosage regimens for this drug were all over the board within certain parameters. So was it any greater significance that it was in there? I don't think anyone could suggest that it was, but in the this isn't a situation where there wasn't a dueling flowchart, because and all of a sudden I put this document in and that evidence was inadmissible or shouldn't have gone back to the jury, and now they've put undue importance to that particular document, and this court is now trying to determine the impact of that. In this case, there was a lot of evidence. This was one part and a simple part, and it didn't even have the duration which appears to be the plaintiff's main theory in there. So the jury would have theoretically considered all of the evidence, and I think, you know, documents play a role, but juries who sit there and hear experts explain, you know, that has a significant impact on their decision-making process. So I don't have any reason to believe that they wouldn't have, you know, listened or followed, you know, what Dr. Prostowski was saying and explaining in a very dynamic fashion and in a way that lay people could understand. So, yes, it did go in. Did it have a significant impact that would have affected the verdict? I would suggest that it would not.
Do you agree that the trial judge didn't examine the admissibility of the evidence in the context of 803.18?
She, which the exhibits that went in for the from Dr. Prostowski?
The ones that Mr. Castle believes are learned treatise that should not have been admitted under the rule. Did the trial judge analyze the admissibility under the rule?
There was two objections to the exhibits. One was he was trying to keep them out because he claimed they were irrelevant and confusing and didn't fit the particular pattern of the patient in this case. And then as a statement, he does say, and the learned treatise, or I forget what he said, 803.18. There was not a detailed analysis by the court at that time regarding learned treatise, reading or not reading. There was an extensive out of the presence of the jury question. And it wasn't that there was confusion between the court and defense counsel. We were trying to get the documents that had been displayed and make sure that only the right documents went to the jury. When the motion for new trial was filed, Mr. Castle raised 18, and then Judge Del Pesco, when she wrote her opinion, went into 803.18 and the learned treatise exception. I think there's sort of an alternative basis, which she didn't necessarily go through in an analysis, but let's say this expert authored this document. So it's not necessarily a learned treatise in the sense that it's a book.
Now, whose analysis is this, yours or the trial judge's?
This is my, and it was cited in the opening brief. It's basically the residual exception to the hearsay rule, which is if it doesn't fit, you know.
Well, let me make sure I understand your answer to my question. As I understand your answer to my question, at the time the trial judge decided to admit the documents that are objected to today, she did not analyze their admissibility under 803.18.
She didn't specifically say anything that, you know, she didn't specifically talk about that rule. It was an objection that was raised, and then the evidence was admitted. But I don't know in her mind whether she had thought through the exception to the hearsay rule and the impact of the read-only and don't admit portion of that rule. I don't know exactly what she was thinking, and it was around lunch hour, so I don't know if there was additional thinking that she had gone through for that. But there was, my recollection of the transcript was there was nothing more expressed about that. It had been authenticated. The foundation had been laid through this expert. It had been displayed to the jury without objection. And now it was an issue of which parts of those exhibits would go back to the jury.
Let me pursue a slightly different concern. If I understand your position correctly, assuming that the document was a learned treatise and should not have gone to the jury under the rule, it was clearly harmless error because, after all, you still were allowed to discuss it, cross-examine and cross-examine the witness, and show it to the jury, read from it, do all kinds of things. Just the only thing you couldn't do is give the document to the jury during the deliberation. So how could that have really impacted the result? My concern is this. Doesn't that analysis pretty much vitiate the rule? Because that'll always be the case, that whatever it is that goes back to the jury that's a learned treatise, well, maybe not always be the case, but frequently it will be the case that, well, judge, it's okay because even though they shouldn't have gotten to see the document, they heard about it, it was read to them, it was explained to them, so this is harmless error. How do we maintain this rule and not result in a decision that basically says anytime you do this, you might as well go ahead because it'll be harmless error?
Well, the two things I would respond to that. One is if you look at, you have to look at harmless error on the facts and circumstances of each particular case. And yes, there are a lot of cases where harmless error has been found, where a document has been, or a portion of a document has been admitted as a learned treatise. We've cited some of those in our brief. But I don't think that destroys the rule. And I think the important part about the unique circumstances of this case and the rule is when the rule talks about read only and not admit, and you look at the purpose of that, that wasn't violated in this particular case.
So what you're saying is that the rule is there for the sole purpose of making sure that jurors don't wind up with a dictionary and start looking up every word in the dictionary.
Well, yes. And if you looked at some of the initial commentary, and I'm going way back, I can't remember the case, it was like in the 1800s, part of the concern was that if we just take scientific documents and give them to the jury, they start reaching their own conclusions about what happens. And what we need to do is have that presentation of evidence in the context of expert testimony. And that did happen here. I mean, these were not documents that were not explored. And,
I understand.
But I think you have to look at the harmless error rule on the facts and circumstances of each and every case, and you know, would there be a case it would make a difference in? There certainly could be. This is not that case.
Just to step back one moment from the harmless error issue, and for the record, can you clarify whether or not your side is contending or is conceding that the algorithm that was introduced and admitted into evidence was a learned treatise?
I don't think that the algorithm are a learned treatise.
Why not?
The author who wrote them was on the stand. He's not relying on some other document. It was his document.
But isn't the issue whether the document itself, standing alone, is a learned treatise?
Well, you know, it's interesting when you think about the definition of treatise. It's a complex, it's a paper or scientific study on a single work. Well, one page would not necessarily be a complete treatise. It would be one part.
Well, I pressed Mr. Castle for a definition, you know, that would be workably usable in an opinion of this court, of a learned treatise. And he answered that. What is your definition? That is, what definition are you proposing that would, by its own terms, exclude the three pages that it were an issue in this case?
I guess a treatise is a compilation or scientific study regarding a single work. A learned treatise derives from the evidence rules. And the learned treatise is where an expert or a witness or the court or another person finds that sufficient, reliable, or authoritative that it can be used during the trial. Okay, so there's a distinction, I think, between treatise and necessarily learned treatise, which derives from the rules of evidence. I haven't found a definitive definition of learned treatise other than what the rule says about how a learned treatise would be used. So I don't know that I have a definitive. I mean, I have definitions of treatise that I can give you from Webster's and Oxford's, you know, that I sort of looked up on my own. But for a learned treatise, it's an authoritative work recognized by an expert in a field of science, medicine, or other specialized.
So why wouldn't the three pages of the protocol that were admitted into evidence not satisfy that description?
I think the ACC guidelines would be a treatise. I think that my argument, my point is that when you have the expert who wrote those, and that expert is on the stand, and he's fully cross-examined.
Well, that may eliminate the hearsay problem.
Right.
But it doesn't eliminate the treatise or learned treatise problem. It still is a learned treatise.
I think the ACCA guidelines are a treatise. And I guess my distinction on learned treatise is their use. Is it an expert or a person in court who's now taking a book or a document or another piece of evidence that we're going to recognize as authoritative and use that and read that to the jury, as opposed to an author of a section or a diagram who now wants to use that diagram to aid their testimony in front of a jury. And I think that it is a distinction. I see that my time's almost up. I just want to make the point that this was a complex trial with cardiology, pulmonary, pathology, many issues. And the only issue that's come up to this court is three pieces of evidence that are duplicative of all of the other testimony in this case. And they were properly admitted and harmless error if there was any error.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, in response to Chief Justice Steele's question about the trial court's consideration of the evidence rule, our appendix beginning at page A68 addresses that. The first objection I made was, I think the rules prohibit that. Treatises are not admissible. And then the colloquy goes on for several pages after that. There was never any mention by the trial judge of the evidence rule. Mr. Goward says repeatedly that the jury was shown.
But you clearly mentioned it.
Yes, sir. More than once. Mr. Goward says that the jury was exposed to this document repeatedly before it was offered into evidence. This is what it was. It appears at page A17 of our appendix. But all the jury saw was this lower chart down here, this diagram, did not have the heading on it, which was crucial in terms of the medicine here. The heading on it says, antiarrhythmic drug therapy to maintain sinus rhythm in patients with recurrent paroxysmal or persistent atrial fibrillation. And we've always maintained that's not our case. That's not Mr. Barrett. He had it in reaction to the heart surgery, and it resolved spontaneously within 48 hours.
Well, your point illustrates the problem of allowing exhibits to be shown to the jury before they're admitted, because now apparently we have a disagreement as to what the jury saw.
I don't know if we have disagreement. They had a big blow-up chart. It was sitting right here, and the jury was there, and it didn't have this heading on it. Then when they introduced this, which is what the jury had, a small, they never had the blow-up. They just had this small portion. It had this heading on it.
Would we find that distinction anywhere in the record?
Yes. In that colloquy starting at page A68, when I'm objecting to the introduction of this material, I do say that. And I believe I said it more than once.
Although, well, okay, since we're focusing on that, it's the language after figure 5. Is that what you're saying?
It's figure. It's at the very top.
After the words figure 5.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But although the jury did not see that, did they hear testimony to that effect?
Yes, some. I took the position that this application has nothing to do with a patient who's just undergone this CABG surgery.
So on cross-examination, once the doctor had testified in direct about this chart, you wanted to say the chart's irrelevant because if you look at the caption, you're talking about apples, in our case is oranges. So at least to the extent that you wanted to distance that chart from your case, based on that language, you did that on cross.
I tried, and he said, no, you don't understand. He had it more than once. That means recurrent, and that fits. Our people have since said that's a different situation. People get atrial fibrillation without any regard to heart surgery. The phrase has been used, dueling documents, a number of times. If I could just go back and retrace how the protocol that we used got into the case. When we were taking Dr. Drury's deposition, pretrial discovery deposition, he chastised me for not knowing about this protocol and filing the lawsuit without having the protocol. That's how we found out about it. So we then get the protocol, and lo and behold, they don't follow their own protocol, which calls into issue his credibility. And it was relevant on that point also. And the other way we used it was if they had followed the protocol, this man would have been off the medicine long before he was and probably would never have had the toxic reaction. The other point that was made, I just need to comment on, Mr. Grover kept saying our expert agreed. He's talking about Dr. Marsh. Dr. Marsh never agreed that this man could be given this much amiodarone for this long. He said, I'm not going to quibble with giving it to him in the hospital for a few days, but by the time he was out of the hospital, it had resolved. There was no need to give it to him after that. And it was a departure from standard of care to keep him on that dosage. That was Dr. Marsh's testimony. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Take the case under advisement and recess.